Good afternoon and welcome to the meeting of the Midcoast Forum on Foreign Relations for February 2012, coming to you today from Point Lookout in Northport on the coast of Maine. And a particular welcome to our public radio audience. My name's Mac DeFord. I'm the head of the forum. Since 1985, the forum has been meeting monthly to hear an invited expert from the world of foreign service, journalism, or academia talk about the critical foreign policy issues facing the United States. Details about past and upcoming programs are available on our website at midcoastforum.org. The Midcoast Forum today is very lucky to have Peter Van Buren, who's been in the Foreign Service for over 23 years. He speaks Japanese and Mandarin. He volunteered for Iraq service and was assigned to, I guess it's the Provincial Reconstruction Team duty from 2009 until 2010, last summer, the summer of 2010. His tour extended through the withdrawal of the last combat troops. His book, which Peter will draw on in today's talk, is entitled We Meant Well, How I Helped Lose the Battle for the Hearts and Minds of the Iraqi People. Peter.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And I very much appreciate the introduction and the mention of my book. I'm the one who lost the war. And so if anyone was still curious about that, that's why I put it right in the title, that I helped lose the war. I was actually, before I get started, I was tempted to chuck the whole speech about Iraq and just talk about how beautiful a place you have here and what a lovely place. I was tempted to put that topic aside and talk about the Super Bowl, and I was persuaded basically to leave both of those for next time and instead focus on the book in Iraq. So if there any closet Giants fans or anyone who wants to talk about how beautiful Maine is, I'll be happy to entertain those on the sidebar. I worked for the State Department for 20-some years. I joined when I was 14, so that only makes me 38 right now. And I had a fairly benign career. In fact, I think of it as largely working on what I call the benign side of empire. For most of those 20-some years, I did what we call citizen services, which is helping Americans when they get in trouble overseas. If you've ever lost your passport while you've been overseas, or gosh forbid, the victim of a robbery or something, that was my job to try to help you out. If you ended up in jail, because Americans do get arrested overseas, the top three reasons are drugs, and then drugs, I would visit you in jail, and I also dealt with the disasters and things like that. And it was good work, and work that I was very pleased to do and proud to do, because it was something that America really could do, that a lot of other countries couldn't do. It didn't matter if you got in trouble in a remote corner of a remote place, there was someone going to help you there, and we were going to get you back to the United States in more or less good condition. And it was a source of great pride for me to do that work. Through a series of accidents and very bad decisions, I volunteered to go to Iraq, largely because the State Department was running out of people otherwise to go there and do it. Most of my career was spent in East Asia, and the languages that I spoke were East Asian. There were very few Japanese speakers I found in Iraq. We did run into a group of Chinese oil investors, and they were extremely surprised to when I spoke with them a little bit in their language, kind of very suspicious about how come the Americans had a Chinese speaker right there. That's the least of my troubles right now. But the State Department had volunteered to win the war after pretty much everyone else had failed. The very quick 30-second history of the Reconstruction Project was, in 2003, we invaded Iraq, and the plan was that we were going to be welcomed as liberators. It was going to be just like World War II. The Iraqis were going to rush out and with bottles of wine, even though they don't really drink too much, and they were going to, like, you know, push their daughters onto our tanks so we could all be happy, and we'd give out chocolate and nylons, and it would be just like Saving Private Ryan. And this was the plan, which had a few glitches in it, and that didn't work out. So we were then going to win the war by having a guy named Jake Garner, which sounds like somebody from like an old Gunsmoke episode, right? And he was going to do some humanitarian aid and save Iraq. And that didn't work out. And then the Coalition Provisional Authority, Jake, not Paul Bremer's organization, then they moved in, And they were staffed by a bunch of people from the Bush campaign, many of them very young people, who all had these great ideas that they were going to try all sorts of their Ayn Randian neocon fantasy stuff, and that they're going to have a flat tax and no speed limits and all sorts of other goofy stuff. I'm not making that up. That was going to fix Iraq. And what a, you know, somehow that didn't work out, and they all went home took over, you know, your mortgage companies and things like that. So, thank you. Then the Army was given the job, and the Army Corps of Engineers. I mean, who would not do better than the Corps of Engineers, right? And they were going to fix Iraq, and they got in there, and they said, we can't do this. This is too big of a job for us, and we don't really know where to start. So then it was handed over to KBR and Bechtel and all the big consulting firms, and they were going to fix Iraq. They took in an awful lot of money to do that, but they didn't actually fix very much. A lot of it seemed to go to security, and they had like line items for corruption, 37%, and things like that. And that didn't work out. Then they brought in what we call Big Army, you know, the whole big green machine, and they were going to fix Iraq because they were all extremely energetic young 20-year-olds who didn't care about flat taxes and would do what they were told, and they had a chance, and that didn't work. And finally, it got around to 2007. There was absolutely nobody else in Washington who was going to win the war in Iraq and solve this whole problem and reconstruct the country except essentially me. And this is where things started to go downhill for all of us. The State Department was handed this task largely because, in all seriousness, there really wasn't anyone left to try it. And Condoleezza Rice had moved from the National Security Council to the Department of State as Secretary of State, and she sort of volunteered us. The initial response from the State Department was very underwhelming. We had an initial little burst of enthusiasm where all the Arabists and the people who had spent their careers in the Middle East, they rushed over there and they said, we're not going near this. And then they had to fill it up with people. And nobody volunteered. There was a very dramatic town hall meeting at the State Department in 2006 where we were all told, basically, you are all going to go to Iraq. And all of you who, you know, they make the joke about striped pants and things. I never saw anyone wear striped pants at the State Department. But they do still do wear, like, funny hats and things like that. But they said, you all are going to go out there, and too bad that you're a bunch of overweight, balding diplomats. You're going to go win the war. And everybody said, no, thank you. We're not going to do that. So then they changed all the personnel rules so that the only way you were ever going to get promoted, the only way you were ever going to get sent to a country that had running water, the only way you were ever going to go a place where your kids weren't going to get malaria again, was you had to volunteer for Iraq. And so I was a smart guy. I saw which way the wind was blowing. I said, all right, fine, I'm going to go to Iraq. So everything was going great. I had 3 weeks of training to go to Iraq. The first week was called, we called it Islam for Dummies. And it was this very basic sort of, you know, okay, look, in the Middle East, guys hold hands, they kiss a lot, and, you know, don't talk about religion too much. Okay, thanks. And then we had a week of spreadsheets to keep track of what I didn't realize was the incredible amount of money that we were going to be spending. And that didn't really work. That was okay. And then we had this week where we went to an undisclosed location in West Virginia. And it's only undisclosed because I don't remember exactly where it was, but it's an old racetrack. And we had this thing where we were going to get prepared for war. And I had never fired a weapon in my life. I had a BB gun as a kid, and, you know, we went through the whole silliness with that. And so we were going to get this thing, and so this guy who's like, he's like this, his arms can't actually touch his sides because of them, and he had a baseball cap and sunglasses and everything, and he has a what I now know to refer to as a weapon instead of a gun or a pistol. And he puts it, may I borrow your hand, sir? It's for the good of the country. So he puts the gun in my hand like this. This is my hand. He puts his two hands around the gun. He aims it at the target, and then he stares at me with one eye on me and one eye on the thing, and he says, pull the trigger. And he says, great shot, good shot. And then he takes the gun away. And that was my training. Luckily, there should have been kind of hints here, right? I mean, it's like when you go on that first date and you're sitting there and your date's picking her teeth and you wonder, you know, 6 months later you wonder how you got there and everything. But I guess I was naive or sleepy or something. I just switched to decaf at that point. And so off I went to Iraq. And I was going to rebuild Iraq. And I had this plan that I was really just going to do whatever my predecessor had done and just get through the year. This was not my area of the world, my area of expertise. This is just something I had to do. So I had this whole kind of mental plan in mind. And we got there, and it was a very dramatic journey into the war zone and everything. And then the next morning, we got up early, and we flew by helicopter, which was really cool, way out to this desert location where I was going to spend most of my year. And I got off the helicopter, and I was rushed right into a meeting with the Army guys I was going to be working with. And I said, "This is great. I'm thrilled to be here. Let's get started. What are we working on?" And the Army guy said, "Oh, sir, we thought you knew that." And to summarize two quick chapters, the very first thing I was asked to do was sign a fraudulent receipt for several thousand dollars because we had held some kind of meeting or something and we overspent. I had to sign a fraudulent receipt. The next thing I was asked to do was to authorize the Sheep for Widows project. We were going to empower. We had these things called lines of effort, which, of course, we had to abbreviate as LOU, line of effort, because no one was allowed to actually speak a full word or sentence because we were dealing with the military and everything. So we had these LOUs, and the goal was every week to tick off as many LOUs as you could. And so one LOU was agriculture because we were in a rural area. One LOU was widows because there were a lot of widows in Iraq, one of the few things not in short supply. And then the other was empowerment of women. And we never actually figured that out. I don't mean to step on anybody's politics, but it seemed to us that the Bush administration was really that interested in the empowering of women. So we kind of figured they only did it just because it made the Muslim guys angry. But anyway, we were supposed to empower women. So agriculture, widows, and women, giving sheep to widows was great because it was agriculture, it was widows, and it was women. The widows were women, but it counted for two nonetheless. And they said, "Great, here's what we're going to do. We're going to give sheep to five widows." And I said, "That's terrific. How much is it? It's $25,000. I said, "That's $5,000 a sheep. You can buy a Toyota for that." And they said, "Yeah, well, there's some overhead and security and everything." And it turns out the whole thing is just a joke. I mean, we might as well. The only reason we were spending the money that way is because we couldn't find a match to set fire to it, which would have been slightly more efficient. And so, again, like that first date, where everything went wrong, I realized that all the pieces of our failure in Iraq were all there right at the very beginning. They picked the wrong people. We picked the wrong people to go. We didn't train them properly. We didn't coordinate with the military. We were encased with our own mismanagement, corruption, fraud, mistakes, what have you, benign and not so benign. And all we were trying to do was check off items on a list to please our bosses back in Baghdad and back in Washington. Nobody cared about the widows, and there was no plan to follow up on this. I started asking questions about, well, okay, what do the widows do with the sheep? I mean, it's like I stayed at Sarah's house. I said, she has a dog the size of Canada. And, I mean, I was kind of imagining. Okay, Mauritania. But I was kind of imagining that the sheep were, the widows would have a pet or something, maybe keep them company. Oh, no, the sheep were going to give birth to, they were going to lamb. To lamb was the verb. I knew about this, by the way, because the Department of Agriculture had sent two people over to join my team. One of these guys was a big commercial agriculture guy, like trying to figure out how to get 2,000 million tons of stuff out of a piece of. And the other guy was a hog farmer from Missouri. Now, if there's anything that's kind of incompatible generally with the Muslim culture, it's pigs. And this guy thought this was funny. This guy thought, he says, "Hi, my name's Fred. I'm a hog farmer from Missouri. I'm here to help you." And he just thought this was hilarious. Needless to say, polite smiles were not really the kind of thing you usually got out of when you met with Al-Qaeda guys, So it never really worked. But he said, they're going to give birth to lambs, and they're going to sell the lambs. And nobody knew how many lambs they were going to get and how they were going to sell them and how the money was going to be made or anything like that. It was all right there in one package. But I must have been jet-lagged or something, and I couldn't believe this was really what was going on. One of the features of life in the Foreign Service, and I know many of you have served, and same with the military, is that you're always arriving someplace and replacing someone who was kind enough to stop working about 6 weeks before he left. So there's always a nice pile of stuff on the desk to get started with. And that's what I kind of expected. But there wasn't that. There was just this chaotic distribution of little projects and things. And no one seemed to really care. And so I called my boss up in Baghdad, and I was saying, look, you can't believe what's going on here. He says, yeah, that's how this works. He says, you spend money, and you spend it on the projects that follow these lines of effort, and you take lots of pictures, and you keep your mouth shut, and your year goes by, and then you go home, and we'll send you someplace nice after this. That's how this works. And if you haven't figured that out yet, there it is for you. And I didn't figure that out. And so I immediately looked at our vocational school project, which wasn't open, but we were still paying for it. And I was driven out to our meat processing plant when we got there. Needless to say, there was no meat being processed, but there were six Sunni families who were squatting in the factory. And it made it their home. They were very happy for what we had done. And they said, well, by the way, the guard you're paying for, he's not here today. Because I said, well, what, we're paying for a guard? Yeah, well, you hired a guard to guard the meat processing plant. And when they didn't process any meat, the guard just figured he'd just stay, and you're still paying him. Well, that'd be nice to hear. But unfortunately, you're not paying him very much, so he's had to take a part-time job. And so he's not here right now. But come back tomorrow. We'll have him. And I realized this whole thing was just falling apart. And my efforts to try to tell the people at the embassy this were wasted, because they knew it already, and it didn't matter. The expression that it kind of evolved and it became a chapter in the book is called "Everyone Was Looking the Other Way." We had been sent to Iraq with the goal that two presidents enunciated to create a stable democracy that was going to be an ally of the United States in the Middle East. That was the kind of overall goal. And the working theory was that I was going to go out there, I was going to spend money on behalf of the United States government to do economic projects, to do democracy building, to empower women, all those things we talked about, in a way that was going to give people something to look forward to other than joining the insurgency, supporting, we just use the word al-Qaeda, it really wasn't al-Qaeda, but I mean the bad guys, that this was all going to be part of this process of winning the war by sort of conquering the Iraqis with our soft power. Pick whatever words. Those of you of the Vietnam era know the phrase hearts and minds. We didn't use that one. We preferred soft power. But it's all the same kind of thing. We're not here to invade you anymore. We're not here to kill you anymore. We're here to help you get your country back on its feet. That made some sense to me. But when I saw how we were actually doing it, I realized there was no hope whatsoever. Two quick projects to make you laugh, and then we'll get serious again for a second. We had our agricultural expert, who was big on building big things and getting more yield out of everything, decided that the Iraqi system of milk distribution, which had been in place since roughly 10,000 BC, was no longer efficient. Now, the way it worked was, with a country with limited refrigeration and limited logistics, there was a farmer who had a couple of cows, and his cows would make enough milk for his family and his neighbors, and then one village over, there'd be another farmer with two more cows, and they would take care of this table and that, and it kind of worked. Now, this was not going to be good for us, because we wanted something much bigger, so the Army spent $500,000 to build two stainless steel milk tanks with some kind of coolant and everything in them. The farmers were going to not sell their milk to their neighbors, they were going to sell the milk to us. We were going to collect it in these tanks, and we were going to give it to a milk processing plant who was going to put it in milk cartons and turn around and sell it back to the farmers' neighbors. And this was going to look good because it was all big. And it never occurred to us in this process that someone else might not think this was the right way to do it. The tanks sat empty. The farmer said, no, we know how to sell milk. We've got this all taken care of. There was no processing plant on the other side of us who wanted bulk milk. It was all for us. And I found that if there was any purpose to what we were doing over there, it was for us. It was to make things look good. We oftentimes got things. The Secretary of Agriculture is going to make a speech in Washington, and we need an agricultural success story by Thursday, so get one. And so we would always have signs in English saying what we had done. We would always take pictures, and there evolved. It was almost kind of a Darwinian evolutionary process that the Iraqis evolved to work with us, if you will. It was like a host, what we could call a like the little fish that attach themselves to the back of sharks, or the birds that get in the mouths of crocodiles to pick out the bits of it. And so these people would come out of the woodwork and say, hi, I want a soccer field because playing soccer will promote unity in Iraq. And we'd say, great, here's money. And oftentimes we'd have a big ribbon-cutting ceremony, and there'd be pictures, and there'd be a banner up, and then there would never be a soccer field. Sometimes he'd take the money and run. Sometimes he would turn the soccer field. He would use the money to bulldoze an area so he could plant some crops of his own. And it was all like that. But we were in on it. We were part of the deal. We weren't being fooled. It wasn't like somebody picked my pocket and down the street. It's more like I went out and looked for a thief and said, would you please take this from me because I don't know what else to do with it. When I finally gave up and said, I don't want to do this anymore, I was brought into the embassy for a re-education. And my re-educator was, in fact, none other than Robert Ford, who's now our ambassador to Syria, who said to me pretty much what my boss said earlier. Why are you not getting this? Are you not noticing what your colleagues are doing? Do you not see what's going on? Why aren't you spending money? Go spend money. And so for a couple of months, I didn't know what else to do except to go spend money. And it turned out to be relatively easy. We had money everywhere. For those of you who have worked with the government, worked for the government, you know that one of the universals of government services, there's never enough money. There's never enough resources. Congress is always trimming budgets. Here we had money literally piled up around us. I had hundreds of thousands of dollars in cash in a safe. We used to carry it in shopping bags when it was dollars, and then when the State Department switched us to Iraqi currency, dinars, because we were not supposed to distort their economy by using American dollars, we had to switch over to copy paper boxes to put all the money in. The Iraqi currency at that time, the biggest bill was only worth about $50. And so we had to fill up a copy paper box with Iraqi currency. And we used to refer to it in units of copy paper boxes. It was about 100,000 US dollars worth of dinars in a box that size. And so, oh, how many boxes we got in the safe? Three, four, five. Okay, five boxes. And we knew about how much we had. We spent this money. And we spent it on things that border. If I tell them to you, promise me you're going to believe I'm not making this up. We spent money on a pastry class for Iraqi widows. The theory was that they were going to go off and open shops or bakeries on streets that lacked electricity or sewer systems or potable water. We bought bicycles for kids, on streets that it was too dangerous to go down in an armored vehicle, never mind trying to ride a bicycle. That actually did some good. They took the wheels off the bicycles and made wheelchairs out of them for people. We spent money on what I can only describe as kind of a homoerotic mural on the side of a. You ever seen the Steve Reeves movies from the 50s and 60s, all the muscle men oiled up as Hercules and things like that? It was something like that. And we paid for it to be painted on the side of a building because somebody thought it was going to cheer up the neighborhood. I just gave up thinking. And I had a rule that if I ever used the word Kafkaesque or thought of the word Kafkaesque, I put $5 into a little box on my desk, and I was going to take my wife to dinner with whatever I had by the end of my tour in Iraq. And by the time, of course, I left, I had enough money to take her to dinner in Paris. We just spent this money, and we didn't really care what we were doing with it because we were trying to make our bosses happy, because our bosses told us this is what was going to make them happy, and not spending it, asking questions, trying to figure out the right thing was not something they wanted us to do at all. In fact, it was quite the opposite. And so my year gratefully ended in Iraq. Along the way, I learned a lot about the military overseas and parts of the book that I'm very proud of, actually. I mean, people tend to naturally focus on the politics of it, and they certainly focus on the funny stories and things like that. We put on a play put on a play for Iraqis about called The Donkey's Shade. And it was actually kind of cool. The idea was that the donkey was standing in the sun, and everybody wanted to be in the shade where it was cooler. But when the donkey moved, the shade moved, and the whole thing was supposed to be like, you know, you're supposed to be kind of thoughtful and flexible and don't try to grab everything for yourself. It was a little obscure. We put on a play. We gave baking classes. We had driving lessons for women. We dug so many wells, I mean, to the point where you probably can't walk in a straight line anywhere in Iraq because you fall into one of these wells and things like that. We gave money to sheikhs. We gave money to militia. We gave money to lots of people if it was a gangster movie, you'd call it protection money. In our world, we called it development. And none of these things were ever designed to do what development really does, which is, someone defined it once as building the base that creates the possibility of a top. things happen slowly. You don't just wake up one morning and have Camden, Maine, this beautiful town with its delightful B&Bs and quaint restaurants and cafes and bistros, right? You don't just build that out of scratch. It takes time, and so development is like that. We never bothered with that. We didn't want to take the time. We were all there on one-year assignments, broken up by a trip home, and so we just tried to get out of there as quickly as possible. Everyone was looking the other way. Nobody really cared about success. What they cared about is the appearance of success long enough for whoever was there. The perfect pinnacle of our cynicism on this was the chicken plant, which we refer to as the Potemkin chicken plant. The chapter in the book that describes this is called chicken. And I take out the second word because this is part of a television thing, but think of a word that rhymes with hit and put it in there and you don't have to buy the book. Please do buy the book. This chicken plant was built at the cost of $2 million of your dollars, thank you. And the idea was, again, just like the milk, we were going to change the way the Iraqi economy worked. Instead of farmers selling chickens in the market, because again, without refrigeration, you went to the market, you bought a live chicken, either the butcher took care of it there for you, you brought it home and took care of yourself, and you had fresh chicken. We were going to have packaged chicken just like you get at the store in styrofoam with things, and this would be somehow, someone thought this was a good idea. There was allegedly a marketing study that was done to show there was a market. It was all smoke and mirrors. It was all nothing. It was another word that rhymes with hit that starts with bull. And it was this, but cut that out. So the idea was that we were going to have this chicken plant. Well, it wasn't going to work. Farmers didn't want to sell us chickens. There was no place to deliver chickens to. The very first time I went there, I kind of girded myself, because if you've ever been to a slaughterhouse or some place where they work with that, you know, the smell. So I girded myself for this, and I walked into the chicken plant the very first time, and I opened my eyes, and I took a deep breath, and it smelled of paint. Because they had just painted the place for my arrival. There was no chickens processed there. The inside of that place never saw a chicken until General Odierno, who was the guy in charge of winning the war in Iraq, he had a large number of blogger and journalist friends and acquaintances. Many of these acquaintances turned out to be young women who blogged. Who knew? And so we would get these people as VIP visitors, and one of them said she wanted to see the chicken plant. She must have looked at some list of projects and picked this out and said, I want to see the chicken plant. We were terrified because there were no chickens there. And the sheikh who we had given it to, who was essentially Tony Soprano, but he spoke Arabic instead of Italian, I mean, he says, Mr. Van Buren, don't worry, which of course means, oh my God, start worrying. He said, we will have chickens for her. I sent my sons out. We're scouring the area for chickens. And this is Iraq. Word travels fast. And the word got out very quickly. The Americans somehow, for some reason, were buying chickens. So the price of chickens skyrocketed that day. I mean, it was like the gold speculation rush or something like that. Suddenly, the price of chicken went up, 300% that afternoon. But they bought up all the chickens in the neighborhood. They threw them into the plant. And when the blogger came, the chickens were rumbling around the machinery. It was incredible. There was blood flying and feathers in the air. And the sheikh got all of his tribes people to come in there and stand around like they were working there and things like that. I mean, if you paid any attention at all, you realized it was not happening. But the journalist that was there, if you want to use that term, wasn't paying any attention. And I was very disappointed because we had other journalists come through and they didn't pay much attention. They always seemed to be interested in some story, but never the story. So we ran these chickens through, and then we invited her to lunch, chicken, which was not the chicken from our plant, because nobody wanted to eat that stuff. This is stuff we got in the market that the sheikh's wife cooked for us, so it was good chicken. And we ate the evidence of our own fraud, and we're very happy about this. We were all congratulating each other until success breeds more success, and the journalist told somebody who told somebody, and we had another visitor, and another one after that. And so we evolved the Potemkin chicken scale, where we would kind of look at the visitor and decide how many chickens they might be worth. So if it was a big shot name brand journalist that likes to wear, I don't know, black tight t-shirts, he would get 50, 70, 80 chickens. If it was a print journalist, 10, 15 chickens. Somebody from NPR, 3 or 4 birds would be done. And we became so cynical that this started to feel like normal. Luckily, my year ended in Iraq. I had gotten in touch with a guy named Tom Engelhart. And I don't know if any of you know Tom. He does a blog called Tom Dispatch. And I had written to Tom saying, I read your stuff. It's very helpful to me. Just wanted to let you know. And he wrote back. We started to exchange emails. And I mentioned to him some of these stories, some of these events. They weren't as funny then because they were far too real in my mind. But over time, humor replaced tragedy. You know, it's a natural process of healing. And Tom said, you should write some of this down. It's kind of interesting. And so I wrote some of this stuff down, and he encouraged me to make a book out of it. I never intended to write a book. I didn't go to Iraq to write a book. I had 22 years of war stories of the State Department that might have been entertaining. But remind me later to tell you one about DJ Domination. He was an American citizen who got in trouble. But DJ is another story. But Tom said, write this down. See what comes of it. And I had taken all these old emails that I'd sent to my mother and sent to my wife, and I started reading through them near the end of my assignment, and I realized there was a story here. And I realized it was not a story that people were hearing back in the United States. They were either hearing, in most cases, nothing about this huge effort. We spent $63 billion tax dollars on this reconstruction project. We spent an essentially innumerable amount of Iraqi money that was captured from Saddam or taken from. No one really knows how much that was. The army spent billions of dollars on its own, never mind just maintaining us all there, and it all was for naught. And no one back here was hearing that story at all. At best, you got a few successes, a few happy talk things. You'd see there'd be a video of some Iraqi smiling as you know, he was picking my pocket or something like that. But you never got the sense of what we were really doing there. And what we were really doing there was trying to win the war. Somebody, after 9 years, had figured out what the point of the invasion was. Right? It wasn't WMDs, and it wasn't getting rid of Saddam. We got rid of him in 2003. It was to create this stable democracy in the Middle East, and we were trying to do that, and we had failed. And it appeared that I was one of the few folks who was sitting on this pile of information, this story, that told that. And so with Tom's encouragement, I put together a manuscript, and when I came back, I tried to find a publisher, and I was very lucky to find a publisher. And this brings us to the second half of the story, which is what happened after I wrote the book. And this, in many ways, is just as tragic as what happened in Iraq, and oftentimes far less funny. I work for the Department of State. I've been there for a long time. And they have a requirement that we vet our writing. We can't just send something out there. And this seemed reasonable. And the rules weren't very clear. They don't want any classified information in a book. They don't want any stuff about contracting that would give away secrets. You know, it made all sense. So sent my manuscript in, and they had a 30-day suspense period. And if at the end of 30 days they didn't say no, it meant yes. Seems reasonable. A lot of important people write books from the State Department. They don't want to wait more than 30 days for their big contracts, as you know, when the ex-ambassadors pen their memoirs or something. And my apologies to any ex-ambassadors in the room or any ex-memoirs in the room. But so they didn't want to wait. So I had benefit from this. And, you know, if you've worked in bureaucracies, you know how the bureaucracies oftentimes mess up your life, right? Your household effects get sent to Botswana instead of Tokyo. Your travel voucher gets lost. Your performance evaluation gets misfiled and you don't get promoted. When all these bureaucratic things happen, well, you got to figure the odds are that one time the lightning is going to hit the right place. It's going to break your way, and that's what happened. The State Department forgot about my book, my manuscript. And 30 days went by, and nobody looked at it, or they misplaced it, or they were busy, or I don't know what. And so finally, a break came my way, and I was approved, and off we went. And my book went to the publisher, and I went through all the editing and stuff, and I was quietly doing my job back in Washington. I had been assigned to the Human Resources Office, helping, we do a test to bring in new people. It's a very far removed from the world of policy and big picture stuff, and it was kind of a nice little job. And life kind of muddled along. I got the publisher said, why don't you start blogging? Because authors blog these days and you should have a blog. So I created a blog called We Meant Well, clever, matching the book's title. And I started having a little fun with that. And then Huffington Post picked up one of my blog posts where I was asking somewhat rhetorically, somewhat honestly, why does the State Department still have 16,000 employees in Iraq now that the war's over? And that's a good question, and if any of you want to ask me that in the question and answer period, I'll tell you in advance, I don't know. But the Huffington Post picked this blog post up and ran it, and this caused my boss to kind of call me in and remind me that there are rules and don't go blogging and things like that. But nobody really paid any attention to me or the book until around August of 2011, when somehow word filtered through the State Department and my world collapsed around me because I wrote that book. In a period of 2 weeks, I was dragged in by our internal security people and told that not only was my judgment in question because I had written a book, but this is before it was even published, but in fact, on my blog, I had linked, not leaked, linked to one of the WikiLeaks documents, one of the things that Bradley Manning was accused of leaking out. And that link was considered divulging classified information, and my security clearance after 22 years was taken away from me. 2 weeks after that, I was told that because I didn't have a security clearance, they could no longer trust me to work in this human resources office. Not that it was classified in any way, but that, and my job was taken away from me. We work under a series of protections that are not unlike tenure for academics. They can't just really just say, you're out, the way a private company came. So instead, I was told to go home. I was put on administrative leave with no job assignments, no security clearance. My diplomatic passport was taken away. I was told I was physically banned from entering the building. My ID card, everything was there, and I was sent home to wait to see what would happen next. What happened next was that 5 days before the book came out, the State Department determined that there was allegedly classified information in a chapter called A Spooky Dinner. This recounts quite humorously. I was invited to dinner by some of the CIA people that were working in Baghdad, one of whom I knew from a previous assignment, and they had taken over one of Saddam's many palaces. And Saddam had palaces like America has Starbucks. It was incredible. There was like one for everyone. But the agency had not only gotten the palace, they got all his stuff. So we were eating dinner on Saddam's table with Saddam's dishes, with Saddam's silverware, drinking Saddam's wine and his liquor. And it was so cool. And everybody was all, we're having a great time speculating about, well, if this room could talk, what would it say? And what had happened here? And all these things like that. And I recounted this in the book quite lightheartedly. And the State Department decided 5 days before the book came out that some of that was classified information. One of the bits of information that they claimed was classified, the CIA had been in Somalia during Black Hawk Down. Now, I obtained that information from watching the movie Black Hawk Down, which starts off with two actors being CIA agents there. And my source for that was Black Hawk Down, the movie. I went back and read the book. It was also in there. One of the other pieces of information is that the United States had been on Saddam's side during the 1980s war with Iraq. And I obtained this piece of information by seeing the picture of Don Rumsfeld with his 70s haircut shaking hands with Saddam. So this was garbage, if you'll excuse the term. But they said, no, you can't publish this book because it's got this classified information. And if you go forward with this, you're running afoul of the Espionage Act. Peter Van Buren's going to spend his retirement in jail. Well, my publisher, bless them, Macmillan Books, said, sorry, we disagree. And we have lots of lawyers here in New York who will be happy to talk with you about this. So, and they published the book. And the book that you have now is unredacted, but I already gave away the secret, so I mean. And it just kind of got worse after that. I was basically cut off from the State Department, shunned, if you will. The security agents came through my old office and interviewed all my colleagues about I don't know what. I was called back in. I was interviewed for 3 hours by two agents. They were playing bad cop and less bad cop with me. And it was really clumsy. It was like some outtake from The Wire or something like that. And they wanted to know what charities I donate to. They wanted to know who in the State Department was helping me. Name names! They were very aggressive about all this. And it just was troublesome. I was told that I was sort of given a sort of odd reprieve thanks to an article that was published about me in the New York Times. In early October, the Times did a very sympathetic article about what I was doing, what was going on. The writer had been in Iraq, had seen all this, and in fact was very aware of the waste and the fraud and the mismanagement, the corruption that I was talking about, and wrote this article. Now, I was told by someone who's supposed to know that nobody had briefed the senior management at the State Department about me. I was not that important a problem, apparently. I was being taken care of, you know, at the middle levels, except that New York Times article came out, and I'm told that one day there's Bill in his office in New York who says, "Hey, look at this, an article about the State Department. That's where Hillary works. I'll give her a call." And supposedly this call went through, and the Secretary of State, Mrs. Clinton, said, "What? What's going on? There's a guy in my State Department doing all these things? What are you people talking about? Every other day I make speeches about bloggers' rights in the Middle East and the need to talk back to government, and you're persecuting someone downstairs?" And I am told this was my reprieve. This is why I'm not trussed up and chained to a wall someplace in Washington. It wasn't much of a reprieve. Soon after that, I was taken out of the ambiguous administrative leave thing where I didn't do any work and didn't have any credentials and couldn't go in the building, and I was reclassified as a teleworker. In fact, I'm teleworking even as we speak. Oddly, I was never really given many assignments. I still couldn't get into the building. I still couldn't do anything, but I was back on the rolls and therefore could not really claim much was going on. This kind of carried us through the holiday season, very joyous time for all of us, and we got into the new year, and I was came to know some people at the Government Accountability Project, GAP, and these are wonderful lawyers who work very hard to make sure that First Amendment rights are not lost. They have represented Thomas Drake, who was a civilian employee of the National Security Agency, who was fired for whistleblowing activities. They represent the people at the FDA right now, whose emails were tapped by the FDA to see why they were reporting problems at the organization there. They've represented airline employees who have called out safety violations. They're wonderful people, extremely dedicated to the First Amendment and extremely dedicated to the idea that if people inside the government don't talk about the problems of the government, then you, the people, have no way to learn these things. We're the only ones who can tell them to you, and we have an obligation to tell them to you. They filed a complaint with the Office of the Special Counsel, which is kind of a whistleblower protection organization inside of the government that had been in place for many years. During the Bush administration, it was basically put on hiatus. The Bush administration put a guy named Scott Block in charge of it, who immediately began working out his own religious issues and personal issues by saying, "Well, we're not going to pursue any cases of discrimination based on gender, and we're not going to pursue any cases of retaliation based on sexual orientation. We're not going to do this, we're not going to do that." Scott Block gratefully went to jail for destroying evidence when his own employees filed retaliation suits against him as their boss. He only spent a month in jail, but hopefully that cleared his head. By coincidence, following the filing of this complaint, the State Department revealed to me, accidentally, I guess, that they're tracking what I do on the internet on my private time. I was called in to be yelled at for some of the things I was doing, like going to websites like WikiLeaks and looking at the things there, and writing the blog that I maintain, and making public speeches. And I was called out on this and shown this list of all the things that I had been doing on the internet. Being me, I joked, I said, "Look, I could do this for you. It'd save you some time. If somebody's actually compiling this list, because they had missed a few things somehow, I could do this. I'm a teleworker. I've got the time." Whatever you say about them, there's just not a sense of humor there. I don't know. And soon after that, I got a notice. One of the blog posts that I'd done recently was a satirical memo from the Secretary of State to the media, reminding them that the new way to talk about Iraq is, everything that's going on there is the Iraqis' damn fault and not ours, so please make sure your articles all reflect that. We had nothing to do with the problems there. And I put the State Department seal to make it look like a fake memo. But it would take someone who was both deaf, dumb, blind, and really stupid to mistake this for anything official. But the State Department sent me a letter saying I had to remove the seal immediately or face prosecution under, I don't even know what they came up with, something from the Articles of Confederation or something, you know, saying you can't misuse a government seal. Now, of course, this is ridiculous. And on the advice of my attorneys, I replaced the government seal with a photo illustration of an aquatic seal balancing the State Department seal on her nose, which somehow made everybody angrier. I don't I guess I'm just not good at reading people these days. And where we stand right now is that I am on telework status, that I am called into the State Department regularly to be scolded by a variety of people for the things I do, including speaking to you all today. I believe that America is bigger and better than all that. I went to Iraq to represent the United States, to do the United States business, and I found out that we were lying to ourselves. We were cheating. We weren't doing what we said we were doing. And I simply came back and wrote that all down. As you read through the book, essentially, if you had been there with me and standing next to me, you would have seen all this and heard all this. There's nothing in here that's I shouldn't say not nothing in here insightful, because that's not really good for sales, but there's nothing in here that you wouldn't have seen if you were just standing next to me. I don't say that guy was a hopeless drunk. I say I watched him drink an entire bottle of gin while I was explaining what I did last week. And you would have seen the same thing. And for that, I've lost my job. I'm 52 years old. The State Department would normally allow me to work for another 10 years. I should be going overseas at this point on my next assignment. I speak two languages that the State Department says that they need people to speak. Regardless of where you put China on our to-do list, it's near the top. And I've served in all three Chinas, Taiwan, Hong Kong, and the mainland, and presumably would have something to add there. There's a lot of other things about me being a wonderful person, but that's not what's important. What's important is, because I wrote this book, because I told people a little bit about what happened to me in Iraq, the State Department took away my job. And they did it in a way that left me unable to essentially defend myself. They manipulated the personnel rules that can't really be challenged. They can assign me to telework instead of assigning me to the embassy in Beijing. And my career is over because of what happened. They've gone out and talked to people who have sent me substantive emails and asked them why they're sending me those emails. They've gone out and made my life not as good as it should have been. They've gone back and pulled all my travel vouchers for 3 years and gone over them line by line to make sure I didn't make any mistakes. I had to write a check for $242 because I lost my taxi receipts from my trip to Peru in 2008. And all these other things. It's harassment, it's intimidation, it's retaliation. And it's partially about me, of course, but it's mostly about shutting up the person who wants to write the next book. The easiest book to get rid of is the one that's never written. The person to shut up is the one who doesn't open his or her mouth. Somewhere in the government today, someone knows about something that's very wrong and is saying, I don't want that. I'm not as arrogant or stubborn or whatever you want to call Peter Van Buren. I don't want this. My wife isn't going to sit there and say, you do what you think is right. My wife wants to know how we're going to pay the mortgage and why you're losing your job 10 years earlier than we had planned. And my wife is not going to do what my wife is standing up with me for. And my friends are not going to run away from me. And I'm not going to be thrown out of my job because you wrote a book. And somewhere out there, a voice has been shut. A book isn't going to be written. Information that we need to know to function in an open democracy in a society, that we need to push back against a government that is so committed to secrecy that the president can get on Jay Leno and brag about drone attacks and then turn around and say, we will give you no more information because the drones program is entirely classified. That is wrong. And I didn't start out to be a crusader or a whistleblower or any of the labels, good and bad, that have implied me. I wrote a book. And I thought it would be fun to write a book, and I thought it would be interesting, and I wanted to tell you all what happened there. But people like me aren't born, we're made. We're made by the way that a government committed to secrecy functions, a government that is insistent on not only prosecuting whistleblowers and not only punishing whistleblowers, but destroying them. Think what you want about a guy named Bradley Manning who leaked all the documents, or allegedly leaked all the documents. And if he's guilty, he should have a trial, and he should be punished. And that's how our system works. But he spent a year in solitary confinement in Quantico before he was transferred to Leavenworth. And now, over 2 years since his crime, he hasn't yet come to trial. Thomas Drake leaked information about the NSA spending $1 billion on a program that would have cost about $3 million to actually implement. his life was destroyed. The FBI raided his house at gunpoint. They had his wife on the floor with a weapon pointed at her while they searched his house. They took away his family photo albums, claiming they might be evidence. The only job he can get now in Washington is he works as a clerk in an Apple store. And this is a guy who went through a full military career, ended up, I think, as a major in the Air Force, worked for the NSA for 10 years, and that's what's happened to him. Morris Drake was a full colonel in the Air Force and worked at Guantanamo helping prosecute the people that are held in Guantanamo. When he was asked to use information that had been obtained under torture, he refused to. The Air Force told him it was time to retire. He retired as a colonel and went to work for the Library of Congress, Thomas Jefferson's library, and was fired because he wrote an article, an op-ed article in the Wall Street Journal saying that what was going on in Guantanamo wasn't right. He's unemployed. He can't find a job anywhere either. There have been people who have been hounded into suicide, people who have lost their lives, and this is too high a price for our government to demand for people exercising the most very basic of our rights. And so without trying to, that's the stage I've been thrust upon. That's what's happened to me because I've written a book, and it somehow has morphed into an act of conscience for me to come to Maine and talk to you over lunch. It has somehow required me to defy the government and risk more punishment to come here and tell you about all that. And I think that's very wrong. You have questions? I'm going to make up answers to all of them. It's a little long, so we'll cut the questions short.
For the NPR audience, I should say that Peter just got a standing ovation. I think it's the first time in a very long time, first time I can remember that anybody's gotten a standing ovation here. Thank you very much. All right, we've got some questions from the audience. First question I have is, do you have any plans to write another book explaining what has happened to you for writing the first book?
I think if I'm ever going to write another book, it's going to be fiction. I was thinking about a boy wizard or something, you know, close to Hogwarts, because nonfiction has really not worked out for me. I have a lot of thoughts on this, and one of the things, with a little luck, there's going to be a piece coming out later this week that'll be splattered all over the internet about what I've talked about here today. That'll be the starting point for something next. I think that there is a battle going on in our country between the people who want to talk about what government is up to and the government, which wants to keep us quiet. And I think that's something worth talking about. Whether it comes out as a book or whether I'm part of somebody else's project, it's a story that's going to be told. But right now, I don't have any immediate plans to write something else.
All right, we've got a couple questions along this line. And that is, and it goes back to your mention of the current American ambassador in Syria when you went and were sort of called in to talk to him. And this question is, in your experience, was there anybody in Iraq who, quote, got it? Mm-hmm. Did everybody get it? Was everybody hiding, or were the people at the very top of the embassy basically unaware of what was going on?
I don't know how far up the embassy understood, but I talked to as far up as the deputy chief of mission, Robert Ford, who's the kind of number two person, the vice ambassador, if you will, and he seemed to be pretty well informed about what we were doing out in the countryside and how it was working. What I thought was going to be somewhat dramatic disclosures to him, he seemed to have heard before and understood. There was this sense among people. It kind of went a couple of ways. A large group of folks understood that we were doing something we were told to do, and they rationalized it in that our job was to carry out policy as it was told to us to carry out. When the United States said that we like country A and oppose country B and go out and tell the foreign ministry where you're serving that, we don't question that. That's what the State Department does. We carry out that policy. And I think a lot of my colleagues never wanted to think past that and say sometimes if it's wrong, if it's not true, that's different than in fact carrying out policy. And they didn't want to think past it, though they were smart enough, of course, to understand what was really going on. By the time I was in Iraq, 2009 to 10, the true believers had all been flushed through the system. I didn't run across a single person who actually thought we were there championing the cause of good justice and democracy. Most people, I think, were very similar to me, just wanting to get through it, but they didn't write a book.
We've got a couple of questions that relate it to Afghanistan. Hmm. The first one is, how do we cure the stupidity? And the same questioner asks, is the same policy being applied to Afghanistan?
Afghanistan is a little bit different in a couple of good ways, and it's not very different in some bad ways. One thing that's very different is the PRTs, the Provincial Reconstruction Teams, the thing that I served on and ran in Iraq, in Afghanistan are run by the military. The State Department and the civilian agencies are subordinate to the military. So there is a little bit better sense of organization. I mean, that's what the military is good at. We had a problem of that the PRT here didn't really know what the PRT next to us was doing, and the one over there might as well have been on the moon. The military is much better about informing each other and talking across lines and things like that, at least within its own self. And so that's a little bit better in Afghanistan. The other thing about it's better in Afghanistan is that many of the rural areas there, I'm told, are really, really far off the grid. In a lot, even in rural Iraq, where I worked, people were plugged into the world. They had, if they had electricity, they often had satellite TV from the Gulf. Excuse me. They watched Al Jazeera. They watched TV from Dubai. They knew what was going on in the world. They may not have been educated, but they were very informed, I think would be a right way to put it. And so it was harder to BS them. It was harder to claim that, hey, America dug you a well. Please praise us in every way. I mean, it was harder to kind of get much enthusiasm over these small victories. In parts of Afghanistan where we're working, people are living a whole lot closer to the ground, not really of this century, I'm told. And so small things can make a bigger difference, and there's some relative signs of success there. That said, and there's a missing chapter in my book. The editor decided it was too serious to end with, and it was called Lessons. And I tried to actually distill out fairly intelligently what the real lessons were. She took that out. It's on my blog. If you go take a look at wementwell.com and do a search for lessons, you'll see it. But those bigger lessons are not being applied to Afghanistan, as best I understand it. Many of the people who worked at the PRTs in Iraq packed up and moved to Afghanistan. The same guys are doing the work. Many of the State Department people are doing the same work there. The big problems about coordinating what we're doing, about understanding that water, sewer, electricity are networks. You can't just fix this piece. You've got to fix all the pieces and make it work. The idea that you've got to take time to build a base, you can't just hope for short-term successes, those things apparently are missing, as well as the uber issue of the whole counterinsurgency theme. If the Chinese army invaded Camden, Maine next week and started out by accidentally blowing half of you up and dropping a smart bomb on the school because they had got bad information that it was a bomb factory and everything else, I mean, how do you recover from that? How do you go from that to please love us? One of the stories in the book is about a farmer who we were giving out tree seedlings to, and he said, you know, my son was killed by you, by the Americans. He said, they dropped a bomb on his house. We don't know why. He's dead. And now you're giving me trees. You're giving me plant seedlings. This is what's happening here. That is a very hard thing to work around. I found out there's a book called Black Hearts by a journalist named Jim Fredericks. It's not too bad. Get it. If you buy my book, then you can also buy this. But if you're only going to buy one, I really want to put... But Black Hearts is pretty good, and it recounts a horrific atrocity that occurred in Iraq where a couple of American soldiers raped a 14-year-old Iraqi girl, murdered her, killed her parents, set fire to their house to cover the evidence, got caught anyway. And I was reading this book a couple of months into my tour in Iraq, and of course I was just horrified by this, and then I flipped over, I was like on page 56, and then page 57, I realized this incident took place about a mile from where I was. It was in our area. The people we worked with every day knew this happened. I didn't know it happened. Nobody had mentioned it in my briefings. I checked with the soldiers. They all knew about the incident, but they didn't know it would happen right here. We were all new. We'd been in the country 2 months. Now, the Iraqis remembered, and I don't know how many chicken plants we could have built and how many water projects we could have done. Even if you assume 100% success, that could have gotten past that. And I think the same issue in Afghanistan.
Peter, we always like to end on an optimistic note, but I think we've heard the real truth from you today, and we really appreciate that. Many thanks.